This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Women are being hit harder by the cost of living than men and are facing higher monthly costs on a lower average income, according to new research. So this morning on the programme, we want to hear from you. How is the cost of living affecting you and your household? What are the costs that are impacting your life the most? Is it food, energy bills, mortgage, rent, childcare? And what cutbacks are you having to make? No more clothes, takeaways, spending on treats? And is there a gender difference towards money in your home? Tell me what's going on. Get in touch in the usual way. It's 84844, that's the number to text. And today it'd be really good to actually hear your voices on the programme. So please send me a voice note on 03700 100 444. Or how about actually talking to me live on the programme if you would like to join me to tell me what's happening with the cost of living and how it's impacting your lives. Then send a text or an email through our website. But do remember to leave your number so we can call you back. That text number once again is 84844. Also on the programme, we're joined by a literary great today, Lynn Nottage, the most produced playwright in the US and the only woman to have won the Pulitzer Prize for drama twice. She's adapted the best-selling novel Secret Life of Bees for the stage and will be here to tell me all about it. Also, the voice of a generation, that's what I'm calling her. Liv Little, the former editor and founder of Galdem magazine, will be in to talk about her debut novel, Rosewater, which is out today. And gel nails. I'm obsessed with mine. No chip nails. The polish lasts for 2 weeks. It was an absolute game changer. But the chemicals in them could be a cause of allergies for some. We'll be finding out all about that. That text number again, 84844, if you'd like to get in touch with me about anything you hear on the programme, but particularly how the cost of living is impacting you, because as British households face the fastest annual increase in food and drink prices since 1977, one newspaper's front page this morning simply calls it a living nightmare. And today, new research by the pensions and investment company Royal London shows that women are being hit harder by the cost of living than men and are facing higher monthly costs on average on a lower average income. Women are more likely to have made cutbacks in day-to-day spending to cope with the cost of living. And around one in three say they could only afford an unexpected bill of up to £500 from either their income or savings. And women are less likely to ask for help than men. To discuss this research, which is exclusive to Woman's Hour this morning, I'm joined by Claire Moffat, a finance expert at Royal London. Claire, very good morning. Welcome to Woman's Hour. Let's go through some of these figures. Why are women facing higher costs? What kind of picture are you seeing for women with the rising costs of living?
So we've been doing this research for a year now, so we've got some really good data on it. And although the level of worry hasn't tended to vary too much, what we have noticed is this difference between men and women. And it is an interesting one, because why are women more worried than men? Now, there's some areas where we sort of understand the difference. So, for example, when we think about mortgage costs, apparently more men own their homes outright as opposed to women. And mortgage costs is quite an interesting one, because looking across the last year, most worry has stayed around about the same. So if we think about things like energy and food, that stayed fairly consistent. But this time last year, when we did our research, 38% of women were worried about mortgage costs, and this year it's 81%. Now, of course, that's, you know, when we look at where interest rates were about a year ago, probably about 0.75%, now they're at 4.25%. So if you are, more women have rent, they have mortgages to pay, these costs are going to make a big difference. And I think, you know, when we look at that in perspective, if you had a £200,000 mortgage a year ago, variable rate, 25-year term, then you probably were paying about £1,100 a month. And now you're probably paying about £1,500 a month. So almost £400 of an increase. And you mentioned about food, and of course, we don't want to be stereotypical, but often women are doing the shopping, so they could be more worried about food because they're seeing the impact of these food prices. And as you mentioned, it's a 45-year high. When I look just anecdotally across my friends, it's normally women who do the shopping, not mm-hmm. in my household. My husband does all the shopping. But you can't help to notice costs increasing when you're at the supermarket.
So what's changed since you started the research last year? Have women's habits or their approach to the rising prices changed? What are people doing?
About a year ago, we asked what people were planning to do because we were at the start of this crisis. And then we've asked them what they did do. So women, more than men, were going to cut back on things. You know, right at the beginning of this, they were talking about cutting back on the heating by 1 degree, stopping heating altogether, reducing takeaways and meals out, stopping buying clothes. In every kind of cutback mentioned, women were going to make more cutbacks than men. Then we tracked, did that actually happen? Not as high a percentage, but still quite close. And again, it was women who were making the cutbacks first. So it's, men have more savings, and the research looked at this as well. So perhaps what happened is that if women don't have as much in the way of savings, they've not got this buffer, which, would have helped. And you mentioned about the issue of, a third of women couldn't afford a bill of over £500 a month. So that's something that's unexpected. Maybe something goes wrong with your car or the boiler needs repaired. So if you've got more of a buffer in terms of cash savings, then you could probably pay a higher amount. But it's quite scary to think that so many women couldn't afford over £500. Now, comparatively, 25% of men could afford a bill of more than £500.
Interesting, isn't it? I'm just wondering why it is women who are being more prudent, who are cutting back. Is it solely to do with savings? If this is resonating with any of you listening out there, then get in touch. We'd love to hear anecdotally what's happening within your own households. 84844 is the number to text. Messages are coming in, Claire. I'm a retired social worker. The cost of living means two of my adult children can't leave home, but I can't afford for them to leave home either. They contribute towards bills each month. Without the additional income, I couldn't cover my overheads. And that's from Sue. Anna in Norfolk says, money has become very tight for me as a mum and a practising artist with a low income. My partner and I share his salary, and my part for buying food, clothes, diesel for the car, etc. is now running out mid-month. Feeding three kids and two dogs has never put me into overdraft before, but it is now. This has had an impact on the housing market, which has changed a lot over the year. What do we know about what women are spending on when it comes to housing?
Well, so we know that they're paying more in terms of mortgage costs and rental costs. But they're paying on average about £15-16 extra a month. So we know they're spending on that. But, there's more households that have single women living in them. So that's a bit of an issue too. You mentioned the person who's a retired social worker.
Yeah.
And, if she was living by herself, then she would get a reduction in her council tax. But because there's another two adults living in the house, then she can't have that reduction. And, when we think about people who are retired as well, or women who are retired, then although they might have had, especially, like that person who had a public sector pension, then they will have seen an increase this year. But that increase and any increases in state pension as well, they might have helped them, but the costs that people are paying out are still more. So even for those who don't have mortgages and have savings because perhaps they have retired, they're still having to pay out more every month than they ever had before.
And you mentioned interest rates. Is there anything we can do about these rising interest rates?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we were expecting inflation to come down. If inflation had come down and there was an expectation by the end of the year, it might look more like normal.
It's come down, but an absolute fraction, hasn't it? It was showed that inflation fell to 10.1% in the year to March. It's down from 10.4% the previous month.
So we kind of expected it would come down more because of energy prices, but then there's this problem of food inflation, so that's pushing it up. And actually in May we're going to see the impact of broadband going up in April will have an impact on May's inflation figure. So it might not go down by as much as we expect it to go down again. So if inflation's high, interest rate rises, we had hoped there might only be one more interest rate rise and then they would start to come down again. Well, those interest rate rises are going to take longer to come through. So for people who do have mortgages, or in the rental sector as well, we're seeing rents being put up by 10% often. Then, you know, if they're coming off a fixed rate mortgage, and about 80% of people are on fixed rate mortgages, they could have fixed at something like 1.5% potentially. Mm. They're coming off and the variable rate is 4.25 just now, could go up to 4.5. But what do they do? Do you hold off in the hope that interest rates go down and therefore you'll get a better fixed rate? It's a tricky situation just now because it's difficult. People want fixed cost, and mortgage is one of those that you want to know what you're paying, but also you don't want to tie yourself into 2, 5, 10 years paying more if interest rates are going to come down.
Yeah, incredibly stressful situation. And you've heard from women who are concerned about both mortgages and rent. What have they been telling you?
Well, we find that when we look at how worried people are about the cost of living in general, women are much more worried than men. And it is interesting.
Why do we think that is?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say. So we didn't ask huge amounts of kind of questions about differences, but that's across the spectrum. So we're talking about across different ages of women, different income bands, lots of different things are looked at here. So it's perhaps they're more aware of it. Perhaps it is that because, they don't have as much cash. Perhaps there's also, for older women, they're more worried about their children. You mentioned that, people's children can't afford to move out as well. So there's a kind of generational impact as well. What was interesting was one of the few areas where men were more worried than women was childcare costs. And that's when I can't really kind of work out, why is that the case? Because it feels like women would normally be more worried about childcare costs. So that's a bit of an anomaly and we can't really explain that one.
Yeah, we discussed that a lot on the programme. I wonder how much of a concern it is to both of them. So you're saying men are more concerned than women. Is this, again, something that you can relate to? Tell us what's happening in your household. And if you would like to send me a voice note on WhatsApp, it's 03700 100 444. And you mentioned earlier about savings. Tell me a bit more about this. Who is saving more out of men and women, and why?
So women have about 2/3 of the cash savings of men. Now, when we looked at kind of the average income for men and women, for men it was about 40,000 and women about 25,000. And that's because there's a much higher percentage of women who work part-time compared to men. Mm-hmm. So that's probably to be expected. But when we looked at the amount of savings, then men had about £14,700 in savings on average, and women had about £9,800. Now, again, it goes back to this issue about having a cash buffer. So if you need to access your savings, whether that is just to pay for increased costs, women are going to use that money up sooner. And that's where it becomes really tricky. Because they are having to pay if their housing costs are more, food bills are up. They're, across the board, they're worried and they don't have the cash that's there if something major does go wrong. And, I think we probably all appreciate that things happen, don't they? We just got told we needed a new timing belt for our car at £1,000. Yeah. You can't always predict these type of things. And, perhaps for jobs, people need a car. So that is a real concern of suddenly you needed that money. And what we also found in the research is that women are less likely than men to ask for help. Mm. Slightly more likely than men to ask for help from friends and family. But in general, most people are not asking for help, and more women then men aren't asking for help. So that's another question. We know in other research we've done in the past that financial confidence is sometimes an issue for women. They don't have discussions about money as frequently as men would have discussions with about money, whether that's in terms of, with family, with friends, with banks, with charities, across all different areas. women don't ask for help as much and they don't like talking about money as much.
And so much of what you're saying is coming through from our listeners as well. You've mentioned cars there. Someone's messaged in to say, as a solo mother of two sons, I'm unable to afford a car. I'm now reliant on public transport to get to work as a nurse. I'm constantly worried. As I work there, there's very little help available. I work two jobs. I have no idea where I can cut back. I have no more savings. Someone else is saying, I'm a single mum and can only survive now on my fast decreasing savings. Again, what you're saying, Claire, and cutting my own food intake and purchases. I'm a fairly senior civil servant. I feel like I can't afford anything anymore. I'm in a tricky position where my salary is just over minimum wage, so my employer isn't giving me a wage increase. I'm definitely just getting by paying bills and essentials. But other than that, I don't feel like I've got money to spend on myself. Doing a weekly food shop has started to feel like a treat for myself. Your messages, keep them coming through. 84844 is the number to text. And another one here, and before I come back to you, Claire, with another question, it says, I'm being affected by the price of living. My poorer health of late has meant not being able to work my old hours as a self-employed cleaner, and the higher costs of all bills together with the reduced income means I'm only able to visit my elderly mother once a fortnight instead of the three or four times a fortnight I used to be able to afford to do. What advice would you give to anyone struggling?
So, you know, top thing is look at your bills. Now, I think because we've been in this cost of living crisis for quite a while now, probably people did do that a year ago. Mm. So look at the supermarkets you spend money in. That was one of the top cutbacks that people made, was actually changing where they shopped or reducing, you know, maybe not buying the most expensive type of food. So if you haven't done that, then that's definitely something to look at. Mm-hmm. But also things like, you know, as I mentioned, broadband, mobile contracts, most of them were linked to CPI. So they will have gone up by 10.1% in April, plus the often another part on top. So it wouldn't be unusual to see 15% increases. So can you do anything to reduce your other bills that you have, like broadband, mobile bills, anything like that? I'd also say don't bury your head in the sand. So ask for help if you're struggling with any bills. Energy bills, get in touch with the provider. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, I think quite often organisations like banks are trying to help people, phone them up. It's better to get in touch with them and ask for help. You know, and they'll kind of talk you through different things that can be done.
Yeah, ask for help. Good advice. Claire Moffat, thank you so much for speaking to me about that. On Saturday, Moneybox, we'll be focusing on what this research shows about how higher earners, those who earn between £40,000 to £80,000 a year, are being impacted by the rising cost of living. More on that with Paul Lewis at midday on Saturday lunchtime. But new research by the charity UK Youth reveals more than half of young people aged between 16 to 25 and their parents sampled say that the cost of living is having a negative impact on their mental health. Well, Amber Proctor is a youth and community worker at Hexham Youth Initiative in Northumberland. What are you seeing on the ground, Amber? Lots of people getting in touch this morning saying how it's impacting them. And of course, this is going to have a knock-on effect on people's mental health. What are you experiencing?
Hi. I think that a lot of what Claire said is very relevant for young people as well. Maybe not directly with banks and that, but hearing what parents are saying at home or their caregivers, hearing that anxiety and that worry that families are having, young people are carrying that as well. And we hear those conversations in youth club of young people worrying about how families are feeling.
What are they saying?
Worrying about not wanting to ask for things, not wanting to ask for as much for Christmas, for birthdays, worried about not wanting to take letters home from school regarding school trips because they don't want to add the concern on. We've recently opened a new skate park, so I spend a lot of time talking to skaters, and you hear concerns that if they've ripped trousers or ripped hoodies, they don't want to go home and tell mum that because they're just so worried about adding extra stress.
And research from UK Youth says one in five say their access to a regular meal has been impacted. You also offer food as part of your service, don't you? Have you seen more of a take up for that?
We've seen a massive increase in take up for that. I would say that food used to be a plus at HYI. We've always provided food, but now I would say it's an essential part of what we do. And I would also say that some, not all, but some young people are definitely accessing the service for food.
And are you able to help out people who get into serious crisis? Like, just how much are you having to do?
We do a lot to support families, and we work in partnership with a lot of other amazing local organisations and a lot of signposting. Our job club, which is a 16 plus session, we do a lot of CVs and benefit inquiries, but we also do PIP applications and help families with DLA applications. And those forms can be so long and so challenging that sometimes you just need a friendly face there with you to help fill those in.
Mm. Amber, thank you so much for speaking to me this morning. So many of you getting in touch with how the cost of living is impacting you. Morning, Anita. I'm struggling right now. 39, single, live alone. My health has declined over the past 18 months, post-pandemic, meaning I'm working less and less. I'm self-employed and run my own business. Today is rock bottom, and the day I need to both close the business for my own health, but also look for a different kind of work. The increased winter costs, insanely expensive food costs, and reduced working means I'm squeezed in the middle. Thank you for sharing what's happening in your lives. I hope that some of that advice has been able to help some of you, but do continue to get in touch if you want to share anything about the cost of living. It's 84844. On to my next guest, the most produced playwright in the US and the only woman to have won the Pulitzer Prize for drama twice. Playwright Lynn Nottage has adapted Sue Monk Kidd's popular novel, The Secret Life of Bees, for the stage. Published in 2001, the book was a New York Times bestseller for more than 125 weeks and was made into an award-winning film starring Dakota Fanning, Queen Latifah, Jennifer Hudson and Alicia Keys in 2008. Now made into a musical, it's just opened at the Almeida Theatre in London. It tells the story of a pair of young women, one black, one white, who run away from their small town in South Carolina in 1964 and take refuge in a remote honeybee farm against the backdrop of a country divided by the passing of the Civil Rights Act in the same year. Well, I'm delighted to say that Lynn joins me now. Welcome to Woman's Hour. Welcome back to Woman's Hour.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here. Tell us about Secret Life of Bees. You've described it as a coming-of-age story.
It is a coming-of-age story, but it's also a story that's very much about healing and community and resilience. It centers around two young women who are fleeing a brutal situation, one white who has an abusive father and harmed her mother in an accident, and the other is a woman who works in her service, Rosaline, who's black, who in the wake of the Civil Rights Act decides that she is going to register to vote, and on her way to vote she is brutally beaten by two white men. And so the two young women find themselves having to flee their circumstances, and as you mentioned, they land at this mystical, wonderful sanctuary, which is a bee farm that's run by three self-possessed, beautiful black women.
We're going to talk about them. Who are they? August, May and June, the young women who they find themselves in a refuge with.
Yeah, August, May and June are educated black women in South Carolina in 1964 and who against odds have created a space, a business where they can thrive. And in many ways, you know, they're radical in that they've created their own religion. They've created their own means to sort of transcend their circumstances.
And this provides them with a refuge.
Yes.
It's set in South Carolina, as I mentioned, in 1964, just as the Civil Rights Act had been passed by Congress. What impact did the passing of that law have?
Well, I think the Civil Rights Act was really a turning point because it legally dismantled segregation, even though it would take some time for it to be enacted, as we know that the civil rights movement continued much through the 1960s into 70s. And even now we're grappling with voting rights issues. And it opened the door for many people, particularly in the South, to vote for the very first time.
Why did you want to tell this story?
You know, I read the book many, many years ago, I think when it first came out, and I remember getting to the end and just bursting into tears and having a very visceral response to the way in which these women were able to build a community.
What did it tap into?
Why? You know, it just tapped into this sense that in order for us to move forward and survive, we really have to figure out how we're going to help each other. Mm. You know, it's really I also responded when I was contemplating writing this as a musical to the fact that the book sang, that there was this lyricism and poetic nature in the book that when I was reading it, I heard each song. As a matter of fact, when the three collaborators, myself, Susan Birkenhead, and Duncan Sheik, who's the composer, Susan is the lyricist, first sat down, we were trying to figure out, okay, where does this book sing? And we decided that we're going to go off on our own and then form lists of 10 places. And when we came back, I think that our lists were exactly the same, except for maybe one place. And I thought, oh, you know, that speaks to sort of the nature of the narrative, that there are places that just demand to be examined in a more expansive way. And that's the beauty of music, a musical. And I think why it lends itself so nicely to telling the stories of novelists is that you can dive into some of the interiority of the characters, that you can tell their stories expansively in ways that don't feel self-conscious, but would if you they were straight plays.
What were the challenges of creating a musical? Because we had playwright Lalita Chakrabarty on the programme on Monday, who adapted Maggie O'Farrell's Hamnet for the stage. And she said it was just her and Maggie, but Maggie was very hands-off, let her do it, because she's not a theatre person.
Yes.
So how did it work between the three of you?
I just want to first say that that clip was Rachel Jahan,
yes,
who's the actress who plays August Boatwright, and she's just magnificent. But to answer your question, you know, adaptations are always challenging because you're basically being asked to move into someone else's house and rearrange their furniture, and you have to be really careful about how you do it and very sensitive. And it's a bit of a daunting task, particularly when you're dealing with a novel like Secret Life of Bees that is so beloved and so many people have read. And so when we were approaching it, we did it very carefully and very intentionally and very lovingly. And I think one of the blessings is that we had the opportunity to talk to Sue Monk Kidd. And she said, I've written the book. And I'm really open to seeing how you interpret it. And she gave us her blessing to really take a different journey. And we did make some choices that are very different than what happens in the book.
Well, if you hand your novel over to you, Lynn, you know it's going to be in safe hands. So where did your inspiration to want to become a playwright come from and work in theatre?
You know, that's a big, wonderful question. And I actually contemplate it every year in a different way, because I think that I'm still trying to figure out, like, why am I a playwright? And I think it really comes down to when I was a child, I'd come home from school and I'd enter our kitchen where there was this big orange formica table, and my mother was a school teacher. And inevitably, she'd have all of her friends who were also school teachers or public servants in some way, and my grandmother, who was a great raconteur, and they'd be sitting around that table with an enormous jug of Mondavi red wine.
Ooh.
And they would tell stories and share their experiences probably from 3 o'clock until 6 o'clock when it was time for them to go home to their own families. And I think that that became my first theater space, the first place in which I could immerse myself in storytelling and understand sort of that communal exchange that is so significant to the ways in which we tell our narratives in theaters.
And you particularly tell the story of marginalized women. Where does that come from?
Well, I think that the women who were sitting around that table, my mother's friends, my mother, my grandmother, who were these incredibly self-possessed, very smart, political women, never had the opportunity to tell their stories on a larger stage. When I went to theaters, and which I did quite a bit as a child because my parents were very invested in the arts, I'd sit there, the lights would go down, but very, very rarely did I see women who looked like me standing center stage. Yes, you occasionally saw, you know, black women on the periphery and aspects of black women's lives, but very rarely did we stand center stage. And just, I want to tell this story really quickly.
I
wrote Ruined,
yes,
which is about gender-specific human rights abuses in the Congo, and there's a woman who is Mama Nadi, who's the central character, and the woman who was playing her would always move everywhere around the stage except for center stage. And we kept saying, it's like, you can take up space. Mm. This is your story. And what we realized is that she was not used to doing that as an actress. She was always asked to step to the side, step back, you know, but never to step into the center of the spotlight. And I think one of the reasons I tell stories is because I want to see her center stage every single time.
Yeah, great story. And, you know, she's probably not used to it as an actress.
Yes.
But even as a woman.
Yes.
And I think, you know, there's probably lots of women watching that who can relate.
Yeah.
Thinking about it, you know, we've just never felt that we can take center stage. Our stories don't belong center stage.
Yeah, which is something that I was told throughout my career for many, many years. And, you know, it's been a battle of attrition and just pushing back and saying, I belong here. And I'm sorry, but... Oh, no, you know what? I'm not sorry. I am going to take up some space.
You've kicked the door down, basically, because you're currently the most produced playwright in the US. For someone who's saying, you know, you want to tell the story of marginalized women, you are a marginalized woman, or have been historically, and now here you are as the most produced playwright in the US, the only woman to have won these two Pulitzer Prizes for drama. That must feel pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of surreal. And I kind of pinch myself every day and ask myself, well, how did I get here?
Yeah, what do you think about that?
You know, I'm incredibly tenacious. I've worked very hard. It hasn't been a simple journey. And I think that one of the reasons, perhaps, that I'm the most produced playwright is that I'm really invested in telling stories about multiculturalism in America and placing different types of people in proximity. And I think that that's not something that people are used to encounter, but I think it's a conversation that's really important for us to be having at this moment in our culture.
Absolutely. Why?
Well, because we've certainly seen over the last 5 years that we've become so fractured across economic and racial lines and that there's so much healing in the United States that has to go on, but we really don't know how to do it. I mean, we're fumbling, and I feel like that gap is growing wider and wider.
So where do you get your energy from? Where do you find your joy to push forward?
You know, I'm an eternal optimist. And despite everything that happens, I really can't explain is that I am a glass half full person and that I just am always looking for places of beauty and places where I can find joy. And I think that most recently I've become very invested in telling stories that are about healing. I mean, Secret Life of Bees is certainly an example of that. But more recently, my play Clydes, which is going to be coming to London later this season. But I just think it's really important for us, particularly now when we're all healing from so many different wounds, to figure out how we can, as a culture, come together and support ourselves. You know, at the end of one of my plays, Clydes, someone says, well, what is the message? You know, I always say I'm not a message playwright, but the message is that everyone has something to contribute. And I think that that's true of Secret Life of Bees, and we forget that. You know, we forget when we close our borders and disinvite people that those people are really necessary, because I think cultural collisions are where innovation happens. You know, we never know what's going to happen when that Mayan woman, you know, has a conversation with an African-American man from Mississippi, what that conversation is going to yield and how the world is going to look different after they make something together.
Amazing. Absolutely loved speaking to you. Thank you so much,
Lynn,
for joining us. And we will roll out the red carpet and put the kettle on anytime you're back in the UK. So come and talk to us again. Thank you so much, Lynn. Lots of you getting in touch about the cost of living. Anastasia has been in touch to say, the cost of living, please don't forget women with disabilities. It costs more being disabled. My energy bill is massive. I have cerebral palsy. I always have the heating on, the washing machine, etc. Now, gel manicures are now one of the most popular beauty treatments in the UK, but the government is investigating reports that growing numbers of people are developing life-changing allergies to Getz gel nail products. Dermatologists say they're treating people for allergic reactions to acrylic and gel nails most weeks. So what's the best advice for women on whether to continue with gel nails or go back to nail varnish? Should they be done in salons or at home? What should women look out for? and what questions should we all be asking, women and men? To find out more, I'm joined by Dr. Emma Wedgworth, who is a consultant dermatologist and spokesperson for the British Skin Foundation, and Lucy Tucker, celebrity nail technician in TV, film and fashion. Welcome both. I'm fully invested in this, having got gel nails since the year 2007. Emma, what's the cause of the allergic reactions that have been reported? What's going on?
So it's a molecule known as methacrylate, which can actually expose and sink into the skin, causing a shift in the immune system within the skin, which then causes allergic reactions. That's redness, dryness, flakiness. And some molecules are more likely to do that than others. And methacrylate is quite a small molecule. It can penetrate into the skin. And that's why we're starting to see higher incidences.
And what are the figures around this? Do we know how many people are reacting?
So it's hard to know, because we know that the tip of the iceberg is what dermatologists see. So what we look at is trends. And we're starting to see that in allergy clinics that we have, we're starting to see rising cases of these acrylate allergies. And that is probably because so many more people are becoming exposed from acrylic nails and gel nails. And it's this rise in incidence that is really very significant. And that's what's causing the investigations into this.
So Lucy, how do these gel manicures work? What's important in the process?
So the main difference between a normal manicure and a gel manicure is your hand has to go into a UV or LED box to set to cure the layers with the gel. The gel offers a long-lasting, high-shine, instantly free gel polish, which in the world we live in, no one's got any time anymore to wait. So you can have your nails on and straight away put your shoes on and put your coat on and jump up and get on with the rest of your day.
Absolute game changer. What are the reactions that you've heard of, though, Emma? What's happening? What's going on?
So what you can see is a reaction either on the fingers, and you would see redness, swelling, itching, pain, flaking, or even just a milder sort of eczema. But we also see them in other areas, because we often touch our faces and we, you know, scratch or rub our eyes. We can actually see facial eczema that can be developed from these. And when you first develop a reaction, it may be quite mild, but actually as time goes on, that reaction become worse and worse with swelling and pain, and it can take a while to settle.
And an allergic reaction to this chemical can have wide-reaching effects as well in other areas. What do we know?
Exactly. So the concern is not just around nails. The concern is these sorts of chemicals, these sorts of acrylics, are used in different types of surgery. So, for example, joint replacements, also dental work. And the concern is once you've developed an allergy, that's a lifelong thing.
Dental work?
Yeah, exactly. So when they're putting in dental implants and things, they can often use these bits. Mm.
Lucy, a lot of problems have arisen with women using DIY kits at home. Do you think it's possible to ever do anything like this safely at home? What's your advice?
I just want to also mention that it's not just DIY kits. It's happening even with some professionals, unfortunately, having clients that are just becoming allergic to ingredients in the products. We saw a massive spike in lockdown, obviously, when the salons were shut. And the cosmetic industry, obviously, women weren't really buying lipsticks because we were wearing masks. So the next thing that soared was the nail polishes and these gel systems that people were buying online. And this is where it's always been happening. People have always sort of been allergic to whether it's hair dye or nail products. But because of, I think, everyone in lockdown decided to be their own nail technician and watch us professionals work on social media. And sometimes they think, you know, what we're doing, we make it look so easy that the consumer can just copy, and no one's been trained. I've been doing this for 25 years. I'm still being educated. I'm still learning. I'm still training, as are all of my peers. You can't just read a piece of paper and say, right, apply a thin layer of base coat. You don't know how thin. You don't know if people at home are getting on their skin. This is where the problems are lying. They're not sure how much to even put on their nail brush. And it's always been happening. It's just for some reason the BBC have picked up and it has. It's just blown up. And clients and professionals and everyone's in running headless and they're not sure, you know, where to turn. And it's sort of got a bit out of control at the moment. Mm. I just just think nails need to be done by a professional. I think that's the bottom line. You have to trust your professional is using the best products to their knowledge.
How do you know what the best product is, though? Should we be asking, you know, if we go into our nail salon, should we be looking at the ingredients list and know, should we be...
You can very much, yeah. You can absolutely have a look at the ingredients, but you have to be, you have to trust your nail technician. That's, you're putting your faith into that person, and that person's only going to be using the best products to their ability because they're passionate about their job. We're all in this because we love what we do, and we use the best products, you know, that we want to use. So you have to trust the professional and go into a safe environment that you feel it, that these people are, they know their stuff, and obviously their pricing can show in the pricing. If you're paying next to nothing for a gel manicure, you have to question yourself, what products are they using that they can charge such a little cost? You know, sometimes we can't compete with the high streets, the prices, because our products are so expensive that we invest in good products that have been tested.
Emma, what's your advice to people who might be listening to this and panicking a little bit?
So I would definitely say don't panic. I mean, fundamentally, these are still relatively rare cases. But as doctors, as dermatologists, we look carefully at these trends. And this has happened before in a number of different scenarios where we start to see these rising trends and then we change what we use. You know, this is an evolving field. So don't panic. It doesn't mean you never have to have another manicure again. I have gel manicures. I absolutely echo the fact that it should be done in a reputable nail salon where they know exactly what they're doing. They've been trained. I wouldn't advise that you're using these things at home. I would be careful about having it if you have open wounds or anything like that around that sort of area, because it's more likely to penetrate the skin. And I think to have faith in both sort of dermatology, but also the cosmetic standards industry, which are very, very good. And we are starting to see some of these HEMA. So HEMA is the name of the methacrylate. Free products where actually molecules which are less likely to cause allergies are going to be used. So definitely no need to panic.
Someone's been in touch, Helen, to say, what are the impacts on the nail salon workers? They'd be exposed daily.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And we all wear gloves. And obviously we change our gloves after every client. And we have to make sure, obviously, all our tools are sanitised. I've been doing, as I mentioned, this job for 25 years. And I have, from day dot, always used, clients come to my salon and they all have their own individual nail file that I keep in an envelope in boxes and boxes and boxes. And I've done that since I started in the industry. It's only since COVID now we've had to obviously really up our game.
And very quickly, just because I've got you here, Lucy, and you're an expert, do we give them a rest every so often? Do we let them have a little breather?
Nails are amazing. I cannot, it's a game changer. Absolutely not. If they're done professionally, they are removed correctly and applied correctly. You don't need to have gaps. You don't. But if anyone, consumer, wants to have their nails done at home, please use nail varnish. Nail varnish.
Thank you.
And you are desperate, sorry to...
No,
you
go
are
on.
Desperate. A gel home system, please, please seek advice from a professional. It's my biggest advice.
Good advice. Thank you both, Dr. Emma Wedgworth and Lucy Tucker, for talking to me about that. And a government spokesperson said that all cosmetics made available in the UK must comply with strict safety laws. This includes a list of ingredients to enable consumers with allergies to identify products that may be unsuitable for them. Anyone who has concerns about the safety of gel nail products should contact Citizens Advice or their local trading standards department. Now, author Liv Little, founder and former editor of Galdem, the award-winning online and print magazine for women and non-binary people of colour, publishes her debut novel today. Called Rosewater, it introduces us to Elsie, a sexy, funny and fiercely independent 28-year-old poet living in South London as she tries to find her feet in a world that's becoming increasingly difficult to navigate. Here's an extract read by Liv herself when we first meet Elsie as she faces eviction from her flat and has nowhere to go.
My rotation is interrupted by a faint and familiar tap at the front door. It's Juliet. The first thing she does is squeeze me tight. My eyes glaze with a thin layer of water. She's here for the first time in months. Juliet looks past me into the flat to one of the men, who, upon hearing the door, reinstated his initial position in my hallway. Her eyes move then to the boxes on the floor, all without letting go of me. I want to stay in her arms. But we first have to manoeuvre all of my belongings into her bedraggled green mini. It's about to be written off, but her grandma left the car to her after she died, so Juliet refuses to get rid of it. Who are they? Juliet whispers in my ear, her curly hair sticking momentarily to my warm, damp cheeks, a combination of sweat and tears. Bailiffs, I gulp down the shame. We have 10 minutes to get everything into your car. Then they're locking the door. I can see Juliet's brain kicking into gear, just like it used to when we were 12 and she concocts some witty comeback that would disarm wannabe bullies in the playground. Though the look on her face is serious now, more brutal than usual. I'll put the back seat down and we'll get everything in. Don't you worry, Else. Releasing me from her tender, perfumed squeeze, she picks up the heaviest box with her thin but capable arms and without complaint walks it out the door and towards the lift.
Liv, thank you so much. Read live by the author on publication day. What an honour. How are you feeling? Congratulations.
I feel amazing. Yesterday we went to some bookshops and I saw Rosewater there on the shelves and I think there's no feeling like it, really.
Yeah, congratulations and massive congratulations because it's beautiful.
Thank you.
And that extract is we meet Elsie. She's been kicked out of her house because the bailiffs have come around. Yep. She's been picked up by her best friend, Juliet. Yep. Who is Elsie?
Elsie is all of the things I think that you described in the introduction. She's someone who is really confident in who she is in terms of her voice, her talent, her poetry. It's a space that she is able to say, I think, the things that she's not able to say with the people in her life outside of that space. You know, she's sure of her queerness, she's sure of her blackness, but it's like life and the world keeps getting in the way of her being able to achieve her potential and fulfill her dreams and take up space in the ways that she knows she deserves to. But yeah, she's someone that I think readers will find frustrating at times.
Why?
But I think because she's stubborn, you know, like a lot of us, she's really, really stubborn. She finds it hard to ask for help. She finds it hard to be vulnerable. She's had to be independent from a really young age. She's had to really have her stuff together. So the idea of not being able to provide for herself or to do for herself purely on her own is something that is terrifying for her. So, you know, this is a love story, but it's really about, it's about different kinds of love, but it's also about two people who are not always able to see or meet each other because they're very much in their own lives and coming from two different places.
Like you say, it explores love in many different facets, doesn't it? It is a love story. What fascinates you so much about this important part of our lives?
I'm a romantic.
That is obvious.
I love love. I think love is such a deeply important and transformational part of our lives, and I say that to talk about not just romantic love, which I think is so important, but I also think familial love. I think the love that you have with chosen family, with people that you meet, and also, you know, with your family and intergenerationally, those are all really important parts of our lives. And Elsie has a lot of support in a lot of different places with kind of older generations of queer black women, with her best friend, with her grandmother, and they all provide different levels of support and different things for her, but they're all deep and they're all really important. She's not always able to see that she has all of this love kind of surrounding her because she's in so much pain and because she's struggling, and when we meet her she's going through something incredibly tough and incredibly challenging. But even if she can't see it, we the reader know that she is surrounded by, you know, this kind of these great loves, and it takes time. And I think really she has to go on her own journey of self-discovery and, you know, yeah, coming back to herself to really be able to see the love that is like literally staring her in the face, you know.
I love this that it's set in London, in South London, and it's interesting that we've been talking so much about the cost of living crisis, and it opens up with her being kicked out of her house. The bailiffs have come round. It's just a reality of being a young person trying to make your way in the world today.
And she's trying to make it as a poet, as an artist as well, which is not an easy thing to do. And she, you know, she works in a queer bar, a queer space where she's not making a lot of money. Like the reality of kind of making money in the arts is that it is really kind of challenging, and she does the odd job, but it's never like quite enough to get her to where she wants to be or where she needs to be, at least kind of in the beginning. And those are really very real things, you know.
And you know, money is a theme throughout the book, actually, and finding home. And she has this relationship with her oldest best friend, Juliet, who's the woman who comes to pick her up in the bit that you've just read. There's a tight bond, but even though they have a very contrasting upbringing, so what is it that connects them?
Well, they have this deep bond that kind of started back in the day in primary school, right? And in secondary school, right? And Anna and Juliet was really supportive of Elsie, and she kind of, we don't go too much into the backstory because this book really happens in the here and now, but she really kind of was supportive of her when people were teasing her or going through things around her sexuality and all of that sort of stuff. So they had this really deep bond and this really kind of fierce love for each other. And she also had a really strong and close relationship with Elsie's mum and her family, just as Juliet had a really close bond with Elsie's grandma and her family. And they've loved each other fiercely, and they've always been in each other's lives. And even though when we meet them, we can tell that there's been this sort of awkwardness,
yeah,
or like this thing that has been unsaid, and this distance and this gap that they've had between each other, the love really kind of continues to be there. It doesn't need to be spoken, it is just felt. And I think I have had a lot of those kind of gorgeous relationships with a lot of my friends from a very young age who are still so important, and it's not, I don't necessarily see them all the time, but the love is just there and it's continuously felt.
And Juliet's a primary school teacher and a cam girl earn extra money.
Yeah, she is.
Explain that situation. Is this something you've come across, women camming on the side of their desk jobs just to make ends meet?
Well, I suppose Juliet's in an interesting position in that she has like security. She has like a family that's helped her to get on the property ladder. Yeah. She has that kind of foundation. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that a lot of my friends have done. Mm. A lot of people that I know have worked in this field, and it's something that she's choosing to do, and that she's empowered in doing, and that Elsie considers doing. And also watches Juliet doing at one point, and that's a moment where she's kind of like, oh wow, I'm looking at this person in a way that I didn't know, is this okay? So yeah,
there's a lot of sex and intimacy in this book.
There is,
Liv. A debut novel, very, how was that? A writer going, this is it, I'm just gonna write. It's difficult,
yeah,
to write.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think
you've done it brilliantly.
Thank you. Oh my God. Thank you so much.
Yes.
I think sex is an important part of life. And I think the different kinds of sex that Elsie has in this book, it really tells you a lot about who she is as a person.
Yeah.
And each form or moment of intimacy, it looks very different. Like, she's very sexy and confident. She knows how to talk to women. She knows how to get what she wants. She knows how to, like, be in control. And then when she sleeps with B, they kind of meet each other on a more level playing field. And then when she sleeps with, you know, the other person that she sleeps with, it's more of, like, a vulnerable moment where she's not in that, like, that place where she's necessarily having to hold it all together. And that tells you something about what each of those relationships looks like. But in terms of the process of writing sex, it was something that I really enjoyed. I think I think like authors like Sally Rooney, for example, are like so good at writing sex scenes. And I wanted to write scenes that felt really believable and honest. And I hadn't read, you know, like any queer sex scenes. Like
not a black woman.
No, I hadn't.
No, me neither.
I hadn't. And so it was important, but it was really, all of those moments had to tell you something about the character. It wasn't just, you know, for the sake of throwing something saucy in there.
How much did you enjoy the writing process?
I loved it. I had the best time. I really did have the best time. I think at the point at which I kind of came to sit and write Rosewater, I was ready to explore this part of my kind of creative practice and myself. And I was going through quite like a challenging period in my life. My dad was sick, and it was a really beautiful and important space for me to have that was separate to that. That just made me so happy. Like, I loved every part of it.
You can tell that comes through. Were you very disciplined?
Oh, I was, because I was like, I've chosen to be a writer, so I have to make it work. And I set myself deadlines. I have an amazing agent, Abigail
Bergstrom. Yeah, let's give
incredible.
Her a shout out.
She's literally incredible, and an amazing publisher in Charmaine Lovegrove. But amazing, amazing, amazing. And we were just disciplined. She'd been with me for 6 years, and I hadn't yet written a book, so she was in it for the long game. And we took our time, and we edited, and we finessed, and then yeah.
Well, that's belief in your talent. That's very good. Mm. And it's the first book to be published by John Legend's publishing company, Get Lifted. You met him?
I have met him now, yeah. I met him. He had a gig in London like a couple of weeks ago, and we had amazing seats. I met him afterwards, and I'm going to be doing an event with him in May as well in LA to mark the launch of it and the US publication. But yeah, all mad and, you know, surreal, but kind of just brilliant.
Exciting, yeah. Exciting. But, you know, you've always been at the forefront of so much. You were the founder and the former editor of Galdem, the online and print magazine for women of colour. Mm. Stepped down as CEO in 2020, recently ceased to exist due to financial pressures. Mm. The Twitter feed is full of people saying, what happened? It's sad to see it go. What's the legacy of Galdem? I'm sad to see it go. I personally was devastated when it wasn't. What's its legacy?
I think the legacy is huge. And I think when you're in it, you don't necessarily realise the kind of impact of what it is and what it has done. And I think seeing the kind of outpouring of love and support, and also the amount of writers and creatives and people who have really grown with the platform. I think all of us really grew a lot with the platform. We were, I was 21 when I started it. So in a completely different place and space, right? And it's been really beautiful to watch the trajectory of all of those writers and creatives just taking up space in the world. And I hope that it serves as a reminder or a blueprint that, you know, just not to be fearful and really to take up space and to just try things out, because it was just, you know, a little idea that I had at 21.
At 21.
That grew into something quite amazing. So,
and she's still only 28. It's remarkable. And the public directory has been created to highlight some of the people Galdem has worked with.
There's very hundreds important. And hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of names in there.
So that people can see.
Can see, work with, support, you know, bring onto projects. Because people always say, there aren't any, you know, but there are loads.
Yeah. And so you've handily put together a directory. Got to mention, because there's some beautiful poetry, because of course she's a poet, and the name of the poet who has written, a friend of yours who did,
Kai Isaiah Jamal. Yeah, they're amazing, amazing, gorgeous, talented human being, and a friend. And I had written the book and I knew that this character was a poet, and I had a few kind of spaces where I wanted these poems to sit, and I knew what I wanted them to say and to be about. And there was only one voice that I pictured, which was Kai's. Kai has such a talent for making you feel so many things, like just really in your heart, you know, and the sexiness, all of it. And so Kai read the book and loved it. And then we collaborated on the poems.
And what has been produced is absolute magic. I want to wish you all the best of luck with it. It's a sublime read. It's called Rosewater. It's out today.
Thank you so much. It's by Liv Little.
You'll have to come back and tell me about all the other projects you're going to be working on, because I know you've got lots coming up. Join me tomorrow for Woman's Hour. Rachel Vice is on the programme. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
What happens when a life coach takes over your life? For the last 18 months, I've been investigating claims that a UK mentoring company is actually a cult.
What we're doing is helping human beings actually gain control of themselves. Not for us to gain control of you.
I don't know who I am anymore, bro. Absolutely no idea.
The only money he had to give them was his house.
Controlling its members.
It was more about apportioning blame to my parents.
These toxic groups called families.
Intimidating critics.
When I've asked questions.
They said, if you leave and you turn against us, we have all those personal recordings of yours.
We will come for you next.
How do you feel, Paul, about the fact that so many people think you're running a cult?
We're not running a cult. Because they don't know what a cult is. They're slurring us. They're smearing us.
I'm Katrin Nye, and from BBC Radio 4, this is A Very British Cult. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.